This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by MintSim, the best way to get cheap 4G LTE data in the US right now. Use offer code ACFREESHIP for free first-class shipping on any MintSim purchase. Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Android Central podcast for Thursday, September 7, 2017. My name is Daniel Bader, and I'm joined this week with everybody back in their home places. We'll start with Alex Dobie all the way in Manchester, England. How are you, dude?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm finally back. I want to say I completely lost track of when I was last on a normal AC podcast, but it's been a good long while. And I'm just left. I mean, of course, we did a live one last week in Berlin, which was a lot of fun, but I'm just left with memories of me, you, and Jerry trying to figure out the podcast time with a 12-hour time difference across an entire four-day weekend. But fortunately, we don't have to do that this time.
I'm not going to lie.
Place at the right time.
That was a frustrating experience. I wanted you on the podcast so many times, and it was like, I can do it at 9 a.m. my time, and it's almost, you know, it's like dinner time in Taipei, or we could do it, you know, super early in the morning for you. And none of us wanted that. It was just it was. But you were in Taipei. You had a great time. We've certainly seen those amazing photos that you posted. If you haven't, go to Alex's Instagram page and check those out.
Even if you have, go back there again. It's worth a second look.
It's true. He gets paid every time you visit.
Dang.
Also back in his home city is Andrew Martinick. How are you, dude?
I'm doing well, not jet lagged, doing just fine with that 9-hour time difference coming back from Berlin.
You're not jet lagged, or is that just being your dry Andrew facetiousness?
No, for once, I am actually serious, and you can tell that I'm serious. It lines up. I came back, and it was no problem. I think the key was sleeping 2 hours or so before I left to come back to the West Coast, and that was perfect. So I was dead tired and slept blissfully that first night, and that was perfect.
That's all you need.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds good. I'm sad I wasn't there, but I appreciate the fact that I didn't have to go through all that rigmarole. I'm just tired all the time. Just for life. And joining us all the way from inside the Oculus Rift, welcome back, Russell Hawley. How are you, dude?
Hey, yeah, I feel like I'm the only one who hasn't actually gone anywhere.
Well, I haven't gone anywhere.
Oh, that's right.
We
were both in New York recently. I guess that almost counts.
True. We were. I had a very drunken podcast with Andrew and Mr. Mobile. That
Speak
was
for yourself.
A lot of fun. Oh, yeah, sorry. I was very drunk. Every time we said the words Moto Z2 Force, we had to drink. So we'll have to bring that back on an annual basis. I don't know. Are you guys drinking right now? I'm not. I should be.
It's not quite noon here. Sorry.
That doesn't matter.
It's 8 p.m. here, so I'm okay cracking open a beer for this podcast.
You can do that. You can even make the sound. Everybody seemed to enjoy that on the live pod, so.
Well, I'd have to go and get another beer, so maybe later.
All right. Well, let's dive right in. So last week, you kind of, Andrew, Alex, and Phil went through basically the entirety of what was launched at IFA 2017, and that included things like the LG V30, the Moto X4, a lot of Samsung wearables, including my favorite announcement, and I think Russell's too, the new Icon X 2018.
Yes.
The interesting announcement of the BlackBerry Key One Black Edition. Is that what it's called?
Yes. The BlackBerry Key One Black Edition, and also the BlackBerry Key One in black, not to be confused with one another.
Which are two different models.
Yeah.
Wait, and really? How are they different?
So the 18T one is just a black version of the regular one with 3 gigs and 32, and the Black Edition BlackBerry Key One is also black, but has 6 plus 64.
Four plus 64, not six.
This is all on TCL. This is not BlackBerry. If BlackBerry wouldn't have been this creative.
To be fair, a lot of it is on AT&T.
That's true.
Yeah.
And that's just bad news all around. Because if you're buying a BlackBerry on a carrier these days, then I don't know. I don't know. What are you doing with your life? Also, if you're buying a Sony phone, what are you doing with your life? You guys touched on the XZ1 Compact. Yes. We can touch
Daniel's
on that.
Just I'm loving this new Take No Prisoners Daniel Bader just blaming everyone left and right, including Motorola in a tweet earlier today.
It was I'm kind of fed up with what the company's doing this year. So we can certainly touch on that. I have opinions on the X4, which I haven't shared yet. But let's dive right into the LG V30. Let's go back in time. We had seen it at 2 weeks ago in New York, but we weren't allowed to talk about it. And then last week, you guys talked a lot about it. Alex, you have one. Andrew, you were there with me at the briefing.
Mm-hmm.
I like this phone. I'm not, and I guess I have to apologize to everybody who read my effusive preview. I'm not quite as taken with it a couple weeks later as I was for the embargo, but and it's probably because of pre-release software, but also just because there are some things that show themselves later on. But Alex, I want to go back to you because now you've had a good long while with the phone, I assume, as your daily driver. Are you still kind of enamored with it?
I am, and I'll give you a few words now, but I want to go back to you and find out what hasn't aged so well, given that you've had it for a bit longer than I have. I'm liking this phone a lot. I still need to spend more time with the video features, which is a big part of this phone that I've not yet explored still, just because I've been so busy since getting back. But I'm on board with this. I think it's, for me, definitely going to be a top like three device for this year. Like I touched on the podcast last week, it has a lot of the things that I really like about the GS8, just without any of the additional BS in terms of the Bixby button, the fingerprint placement. Having used the camera on and off, I think for me, this is definitely the main camera is at least GS8 level. I think you get a lot out of LG's post-processing out of that super bright lens. I'm also really liking the fact that the wide-angle lens is just much improved again. LG's stepping that up a lot more. And also just the small things, like the haptics, the fact that haptics are a lot tighter. It feels a lot more like an Apple or a Samsung kind of press, that really sort of sharp response that you get. It doesn't feel rattly at all. So, I mean, you could look at this and say it's a clone of the Samsung design language. That's probably a fair criticism. But in terms of just being a really great all-round phone that's fast, does everything you want, has all these differentiating camera features, I could... You know, not to spoil my review next week, but it's like a solid recommendation for me. But I'm curious to learn what hasn't aged so well for you over the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, I agree with everything you say. It's mainly the photography in low light is not quite as good as I hoped, and It's mainly that not everything, like the pre-release software could have something to do with it. My camera derps all the time when I open it. It takes 3 or 4 seconds to even be usable. But we do know that I'm on older software than you are. So that could account for a lot of it.
I mean, my camera loads pretty much instantly.
Yeah.
This is with an SD card in there. I mean, LG's camera still isn't quite as fast as Samsung's. It does tend to LG cameras have always done this. They would take the time so that everything is kind of, not basically not moving so that you'll get the best possible capture. I got to say, my experience of this in low light has been the exact opposite to you. I've been really, really impressed with the way this is handled low light situations. I haven't done side by side directly with the S8 Plus yet, but I've taken a lot of pictures in situations where I've also used the S8 Plus, and I've been very impressed with what the V30 has been able to produce. That said, I think the current firmware that I have, which again is a little bit later than what you have, it does tend to underexpose just a little bit. You sometimes need to adjust the exposure. And another thing which I found sometimes affects low light performance, nothing to do with the camera, but just the screen at very low brightness levels, you will basically the blacks on the display will be crushed to the point where you can't really get much shadow detail on the display, which makes it really hard to actually, you know, judge exposure properly. So you might end up tapping a really bright area, cranking the exposure up, thinking that you need to, when actually it's just the display not displaying those shadow details quite as well. And that kind of speaks to my main criticism of this phone right now, and it may be a pre-production thing, but just something I've seen. display banding that a lot of people have been talking about. There's definitely a little bit of that on my unit. And also, like I was talking about, it obviously doesn't have the super high brightness mode that some Samsung phones do. And also very, very low brightness levels. You don't get that dynamic range that you do on a Samsung screen.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And that's why I don't really want to harp on low light performance at the moment, because I'll wait until I have a retail unit to pass judgment. We haven't seen dramatic overhauls of photo quality going from pre-production to final software in previous LG phones, but it's been enough to warrant sort of a shift in opinion. So again, like there's a couple of other things too. Like I find the decision to go with a 16 megapixel main camera to be a little bit suspect, given the success LG had with the 13 megapixels on the G6. And
yeah, that's the weirdest thing to me. Like, the G6's camera is really, really good. You're telling me this might be like a side grade?
No, it isn't. It's the same pixel size. It's just there's more of
them. But I'm not talking about sensors or I'm saying like outright quality. Are you saying it's like has the same characteristics as the G6? Like, why didn't they just go with the like, what did you benefit from here with a different sensor?
You benefit from just a sheer resolution boost. If the pixel size is the same, and you can then, you know, fit a higher resolution in there, and you have a brighter lens, and you have improved post-processing, then why would you stay at 13? What reason is there to do that?
Is the G6, it has one micron pixels?
Yeah, both do.
Oh, okay.
I thought the G6 was like 1.12.
Yeah, I think it's 1.12. Because it's
let me double check.
I mean, look, all I know is that the G6 apparently has a 1/3.06-inch lens or sensor with 1.12 micron
the
pixels.
The G6 is 1.12 microns.
But. Whereas the V30 has a slightly smaller main sensor with smaller pixels. I think I can't be sure, but anyway, it's a minor detail, but I don't know. It just does seem like a little bit of a side grade. I'm hoping that, like with the G6, LG can pull a rabbit out of a hat and use some post-processing. But anyway, everything else about the phone, especially the audio performance, is outstanding. I found listening to high impedance headphones to be basically just beautiful. I have a couple, you know, fairly high impedance headphones that I like to pull out of every once in a while. And, you know, it's a shame Jerry's not here to talk about this, but this thing is very capable. It has some really neat features. You can apply filters to the audio to get just the right amount of response. It has a really versatile equalizer with presets that you'll actually want to use. It's not just a preset that, you know, ups the bass and you know, flattens the mids so that you get this like extra punch from really low quality headphones. And as you said, the haptics are probably the best I've found outside of the iPhone. Like, these are incredibly precise haptics for any phone, but I was blown away just how much of a difference it made when you navigate through Android, because on the iPhone, you don't get haptic feedback on, say, the, you know, regular presses, right? It's only when you press the home button. Whereas with Android, you can make it so that whenever you press the navigation buttons, you get that feedback. And I wasn't aware of how much of a difference it would make going from, you know, any other phone, especially like, you know, Andrew, the first thing you pointed out with the Essential phone is that the haptics were just so bad.
Yeah. I think the haptics on the Essential phone are bad just in the way that it felt like an afterthought. They just threw in a vibration motor and that's what it feels like, which is different from the way that the G6 wasn't great. The G6s are just weak and kind of non-committal, and they feel like they're a little bit behind versus like you're talking about with the iPhone, where it feels really solid, and the same on the V30. There's not just good and bad. There's different characteristics to the way that the haptics work, and you only really notice them. It's not one of these things where you're just completely thrown off unless you've used a bunch of different phones and you know what you like. I think it's one of those things. I mean, people would be like, wow, you're going on and on about the haptic and, you know, performance of a phone, but it really does make a difference in just how solid a phone feels. You even have like something like the Essential Phone feels amazingly well built, and then like you hit the home button and it feels kind of rattly, and it kind of detracts from the experience.
I mean, going back to that as well, there are a lot of things in the Essential Phone that seem to kind of stem from not to do a disservice to them, but the fact that it's basically Babi's first smartphone, and there are a lot of engineering things that you don't necessarily figure out in your first product that you then have to kind of iterate on. And this, I'm not sure what kind of motor they're using in this, but it's something you notice if you touch the floating bar, the kind of haptic animation almost that you get when you press that button, it kind of follows the animation that you see on screen, and it's kind of a longer vibration, but it doesn't really feel like a vibration. It's almost hard to describe. And the same thing with the home button. As you see the icons rising up, you have this kind of longer vibration, but again, one that feels very sharp. And it seems like a minor detail, but if you're using a phone, especially when you're typing, that every single vibration is rattly and kind of loose. It makes the product feel like it isn't put together as solidly as it might otherwise.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things about the Essential Phone that betray its company's youth. Mm-hmm. Especially in terms of customer service and all these other things. But let's...
Yeah, do we want to touch on that at all, that whole mess with emails and stuff?
I don't know. Finish out the V30 first?
Look, I think that V30 has the potential to be the best phone, the best Android phone of the year. And I speak, having played with the S8 and the Note 8 and basically every other flagship. And I just hope that some of the wrinkles can be flattened before release. The issue is that we don't know when it's coming out. It's sometime this fall, likely early October, and it's well after the Note 8 comes out. So this is LG's, Achilles heel. It announces phones so far in advance and doesn't
giving us the date, let alone it just being in the future.
Right, and then it relies on the carriers to disseminate that information, and it does not own any of the message. That's my problem with LG, is that it lets the carriers dictate terms the way that Samsung no longer does. And we saw this yesterday with the mobile services manager DT Ignite Z camera BS that apparently happens when you insert a Verizon phone into the Verizon SIM into the unlocked version. Andrew, do you want to just talk about that a little bit? Because I think it's worth bringing up. And it's not specific to the LG V30, by the way.
Right, it's not specific. I mean, we've talked about this DT Ignite software that carriers basically use it as something that's already part of, correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, but it's already part of the system. It already has all of its permissions declared from the start with the startup of your phone. And when you use a SIM card from a carrier that knows that this is there, they use this as a way to load and install software on your phone when you put a SIM card in it. So, for example, when you put the Verizon SIM card in the current batch of V30s that are out there, it hooks into this DT Ignite software and says, okay, I'm going to download all of this bloatware crap because I know that it's there. And the user didn't have to accept or give permissions to anything because it was already defined from the start because it's part of the system. And so that's why there was kind of this hullabaloo of, okay, what's all this crap on my V30? All of a sudden, like, shake fist at LG, which, yes, part of it is the fact that LG is still one of these big manufacturers that that bends on this kind of stuff. But it's also, this never really went away. We've been talking about DT Ignite for years with the carriers.
And it, in and of itself, isn't necessarily a bad thing.
It's a tool for the carriers to use.
Yeah, and you could set it up so that when it connects to your network, it's there. It can download all the apps that you need to best use the features of that network, and there is nothing wrong with that. And that maybe was the original intent, but of course, when you have anything that lets a carrier just install stuff on your phone without your permission, there's always going to be someone that takes that too far, and that's what we saw elements of this week.
So the V30 with the Verizon SIM card in it was loading an app called Z Camera and some other stuff that was showing lock screen ads that took over like half of the lock screen on the V30 just because you put a Verizon SIM card in it. And that, when you start just throwing ads on there in what you thought was just an unlock unbranded phone, that's where you start to get mad at LG.
There are very few situations in which a lock screen ad on a phone is, you know, either through the manufacturer, through the carrier, is okay. That is something that needs to be communicated up front. That is something that is communicated up front in Motorola phones, where that is the selling point. Like, you get the phone for less because you opt into seeing these ads. Right. That shouldn't be something that you just find out when this crap pops up in your lock screen randomly one day, which is what we're seeing right now. Before we get into more detail, worth mentioning, these are pre-production units. The pre-production US ones, like all LG phones, the unlocked US model shares the same model number and hardware SKU as the US cellular one. So given that this is pre-production software, possible that there's some US cellular stuff that's been left behind as LG is developing the ROM for both of these phones at the same time.
Hopefully that is the case and it's just a coincidence. But Russell, I mean, you've warned about these things in the past. You are, to say skeptical of the carrier's intentions would be maybe an understatement. This is a slippery slope, I guess. Carriers are not your friends. They're here to make money from you. And in addition to making money from you, they're making money from companies that want access to your eyeballs. This is not new. Where is the compromise here? Because there are three parties at play when you buy an Android phone. There's Google, there's the carrier, and then there's the manufacturer.
Well, I mean, so this is where it becomes a problem. Like, you have this particular situation feels really wrong to me because it was an unlocked phone. Like, if you buy a phone from Verizon or you buy a phone from T-Mobile, there's an understanding that there's going to be some stuff on there that you may not want because of those deals that were made. But to make those software changes over the air, which is something that Verizon, I think, was actually the first of the carriers to do. Through the Pixel. I put my Verizon SIM in the Pixel, and Verizon's support software was on my phone now. And so from that perspective, having the Verizon support software, that was cool because it felt like Verizon was actually starting to support the unlocked market. But this is just way too far to change the core functionality of the operating system, in the camera and in the lock screen, and not even in a very good way. Like Alex said, a lot of these ads, they took up more than half of the screen and in some ways impeded functionality on the lock screen. It just doesn't even make sense.
Yeah. I mean, this is par for the course. Verizon, as we know, also changed its unlimited plans in the last couple of weeks to be a little bit less generous than the initial single plan that was announced.
So nice.
That was announced in February. So we had this, what I call this golden age of unlimited plans between February and late August, where all the carriers were in earnest trying to win over customers without necessarily sacrificing the experience. And then, as we've seen with many carrier deals over the years, things get clawed back, and Verizon went back a little. I think they swung a little bit too far in the other direction. They are now they're now limiting video streams to 480p for everybody on the network if you buy the cheaper plan, and 720p if you go with the slightly more expensive plan. But there's all these stipulations. And I guess before I move on to other phones, Andrew, I'd like to talk a little bit about T-Mobile's announcement yesterday, mm-hmm. that the company is now bundling Netflix with every family plan starting September 12th. What does this do for both T-Mobile and the U.S. smartphone or cellular market in general?
So this was basically T-Mobile's response to Verizon getting tied up with, what is it? Comcast NBC? and AT&T buying DirecTV to try to, you know, have these content offerings where, you know, AT&T is the perfect example because it actually just bought a TV provider and then started offering, you know, free HBO Go to customers and, you know, above and beyond that, doing zero rating and giving you deals, you know, kind of this bundle deal. If you have DirecTV, you get a better deal on AT&T and you can get truly unlimited data and all that kind of stuff. So T-Mobile doesn't really have the leverage to buy out something like that. And I don't think that T-Mobile is interested in getting into a huge situation like that. So it said, hey, Netflix has 50 million or so subscribers in the US, subscriber accounts, we should say. I'm sure 300 million people are using 50 million accounts, but they're saying that's a huge market for them where they can say, hey, you're already buying this thing for $10 a month. We'll just give it to you for free if you're a T-Mobile customer. And they're doing it the simplest way. They're saying if you already have Netflix, you can just link your account to us and we'll start paying for it. If you don't yet, you can sign up through us and you'll just get it for free from the start. And so I don't see it as that big of a move, but it's just a simple no-brains, like, this is win-win for T-Mobile. They don't have to do any kind of crazy marketing. It's very simple to say you get Netflix for free. If you're a Netflix subscriber, it effectively just gives you $10 a month off of your plan, which is it's an easy value proposition for them.
Sure. And Russell, like, to arguably Netflix has far more cultural weight than any other streaming service in the US. I mean, even Hulu doesn't come close to the brand recognition of Netflix, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, is this the right move for them, in your opinion?
I mean, this is the direction that Netflix has been heading in for a long time. Netflix wants, you know, people to use all of their screens to consume Netflix. That's always been their strategy. And mobile first was not the way that they approached things when they started, because that wasn't the direction. But it really feels like that's where they are now, because they know people are sitting and watching all of this stuff on their phones and tablets. So, yeah, I mean, this guarantees that a vast majority of T-Mobile subscribers are, if they don't already have Netflix, are now going to have Netflix. And not even, you know, not worry about things like, you know, sharing a single account amongst 5 or 6 friends. Like, this guarantees that these people all have individual accounts. And at a minimum, that's a lot more data for Netflix on, you know, things like original programming and stuff like that.
So the other part of this that I find really interesting is T-Mobile's insistence that you only get this deal if you have two or more lines on two or more lines of T-Mobile One, which is the company's all-in unlimited plan. And I find this fascinating because John Legere on the call yesterday talking about this new deal said that he is in the business of selling T-Mobile One. That is it. T-Mobile just wants to sell you this one thing. It's like Netflix. Netflix does not exist to sell you phones. Netflix wants to sell you a $10 a month streaming subscription service. And it's fascinating because it's the only company, it's the only carrier that does not have a vested interest in selling you content that it owns. I think even, you know, Sprint now owns most of Tidal, and it's invested in selling you a subscription to Tidal every month. Tidal is inevitably going to get into original programming on the video side, just like Spotify and Apple and every other company. Obviously, Verizon, which is the brunt of every joke in the world, owns Oath, which is Yahoo plus AOL plus Fire in a dumpster. And AT&T owns DirecTV. So, not to mention the fact that it's almost buying Time Warner Cable, which has other implications. So
it is definitely a different strategy, and it's kind of been going this way for a while because T-Mobile is slowly and then very aggressively in the last 6 months, pushing everyone to be on one plan, because that gives T-Mobile the most flexibility in terms of knowing exactly what you're at. Like, getting your average revenue per user up has always been an issue for T-Mobile because they've had such a varied number of plans and all these prepaid plans and everything like that. Getting people to standardize on one and then simply finding little areas like adding Netflix to your plan that's a small outlay of cash for T-Mobile, but lets them bring more people onto T-Mobile One is genius, because they don't, their marginal cost of adding an additional user, an additional line is very, very low, but they will know for sure what their amount of new revenue on that additional line is, because it's going to be the same plan every single time. And that's something that is key. It's been key for T-Mobile going to unlimited. Obviously there's a little bit of that variable cost in that, like, people use different amounts of data, but it makes it super simple and it lets them do all of these things like giving you Netflix or giving you T-Mobile Tuesdays free stuff and all that kind of thing. And it's a typical play, because it's all this promotional stuff that, you know, less than 100% of customers will actually use. You know, yes, Netflix is a tougher example there because so many people have Netflix, but things like T-Mobile Tuesdays, it's like, it sounds like a fantastic deal and you may do it once or twice, but I would love to see how many people are actually taking them up on all of those promotional deals week after week after week. So they can keep adding all of these things to get people enticed, and then they get onto T-Mobile One and now they're paying $70 a month and that's it. They're fixed. They're not going anywhere else. If you're on Simple Choice, you know, the previous type of plan, you can't do anything to your plan anymore. You're locked out unless you go to T-Mobile One. And
right,
that's their goal, is to have 100% of customers on T-Mobile One.
And I think they're up to, I thought he said the vast majority of users are on T-Mobile One already.
Yeah, I mean, all they had to do was start throwing people free iPhones, free Galaxy S8s, free additional lines, all that kind of stuff, and people jump at it. They've done this probably three times in total, where they've completely re-architected all of their plans and tried to push people to get over there. And that's all you have to do. Say, hey, you get a free Galaxy S8 with a set of rebates over 12 or 24 months or something. Just come to T-Mobile One. And everybody goes, all right. And then they show in, and then they're locked in.
And it's working, because T-Mobile was the number one adder of new subs for Q2. There were 1.3 million net adds in the
second
quarter.
Which is insane.
And I think it overperformed, it overextended, meaning that it accounted for more than 100% of the net adds for that quarter in the U.S. So it stole customers from other carriers, which is exactly what their goal is. Alex, I have a question for you before we move on. What's the relationship mm-hmm. like between phone owners and network and customers in the UK compared to the US? For example, is it just something that you pay for every month and you don't interact with the carrier at all?
I mean, it depends on how you buy your phone. Obviously, things are a bit different over here because not every Android phone has its own individual SKU for each carrier, the way things tend to work in the US in that way. So, you know, for example, if you buy a carrier branded GS8, if you really want to unlock it, you can unlock it. And if you really want to debrand it, you can debrand it pretty easily through Odin. Not all phones are as easy to do that with, and that is kind of an enthusiast level thing. But still, you know, it's the same unit that gets sold across all the carriers, so there's less technical difference between them, which makes them more interoperable. And even if you don't debrand, you can still unlock, get an unlock code. Even iPhones, after 6 months, you can unlock and take to a different carrier. In terms of the relationship between the carrier, most people still do buy through carrier stores. We have Carphone Warehouse over here, which will sell you a plan through them on any one of the networks. They have slightly different rates compared to, you know, just going in a carrier store and buying. They used to have a direct competitor called Phones for You, which is no longer around. But yeah, basically, if you want to buy an unlocked phone, a completely unlocked SIM-free phone on the high street, you either, if it's Samsung, go to a Samsung store. If it's Apple, go to an Apple store. For anyone else, you go through Carphone. And of course, you have online retailers who will sell you directly as well. So unlocked phones are still more of a thing over here than they are in the US. It's not quite so clear cut, though. A lot of people will still go into a carrier store or have that branded phone that maybe has, you know, bloatware or whatever else on. And, you know, we're talking about selling content with a phone plan. That's kind of a thing over here. Not so much. E, for instance, they're owned by BT. They'll sell you, well, not sell you, but they'll give you a BT Sports subscription if you have a sufficiently high enough end E plan. Three has also experimented with doing like a binge on type thing, not across as many platforms as Timo has in the US, but that's something that's creeping across here as well. So there are some common trends, but basically it's easy to go unlocked here. If you do get a carrier branded phone, it's easy to get rid of that stuff over here, and it's easy to unlock. So similar trends, but the you know, we benefit from the fact that you know, it's just easier to get rid of some of that stuff.
Right. Yeah, that's how it is, I think, in most of Europe. It's just fairly easy to get online.
And actually, being in Germany for the past week is the first time I've spent any length of time in Europe since we got rid of roaming fees between European countries. So, you know, usually when we're over there, we maybe have the issue of, okay, what do you do for data? Do you roam? Maybe you have to pay some money. Maybe you get a local SIM. You know, for me, when I land, I have a couple of SIMs. Both just connect the network as usual, and your UK allowances just work wherever you are in Europe, which is fantastic.
Yeah. That sounds nice. Okay. Let's move on. Andrew, you published a little review a couple days ago.
Little one. Short, concise.
Short, sweet. A couple photos in there. Alex, you killed this video, like murdered it. We're talking about the Galaxy.
Killed the crap out of it.
And then you went back and killed it again.
how many deaths?
Just to watch it die, yeah. So we're talking about the Galaxy Note 8, right?
Yeah, so we didn't speak about it last week for obvious reasons. Talked a little bit about it after the briefings on, or the announcement 2 weeks ago. But let's revisit it. Andrew, is this the phone to buy in September 2017?
With no other caveats, like you don't care about money or anything like any important thing like that, you absolutely have to look at it. I don't see how, if you want like the top end phone, you don't look at the thing. The only thing that's going against it is phones like the Galaxy S8 Plus that are a couple $100 less at this point because they're, you know, 6-7 months old. And then assuming that the V30 comes in at a reasonable price, which isn't a given, but is kind of an assumption, you also have to look at that. Those are really the only two things. It's just size and price for me.
Yeah. And this is such a dead ringer to the Galaxy S8 Plus. I mean, it's a little bit more square. It has the S Pen, which you'll never use, even though you say you will.
I don't know. I mean,
no, you'd never use it.
You'd never. It depends. You can't say you're never going to use it. And I'm with Michael Fisher on this. I mean, granted, it's been like 3 years since I could buy a Note that didn't explode. But when I used a Note 4, which yes was the last Note you could actually buy in the UK, I didn't use it for drawing. I didn't use it for note taking. You know, I'm faster typing on glass than I am writing with a pen. My handwriting is terrible, like I suspect most of us. But when I use an S Pen, it's for precise input. I use it the same way I would use a mouse on a computer. And it maybe isn't something that you use every single day, but when you need to use it for precise selection or just to get around more precisely or more quickly than you would be able to with a big stubby finger, that I think is where it adds value. And it won't for everyone. Maybe you won't know whether it will for you until you actually bite the bullet and buy a Note. But for a lot of people who've used Notes over the years, I think this is something that they've found. And that's a legitimate point of value. I mean, a lot of people have tried to emulate the Note with the S Pen. LG tried and failed. It's the only phone left that has this kind of Wacom input that is really fast, really precise. And a lot of people still want that.
I agree that it absolutely works. I think that if you're if you're somebody that wants that precise input, you know it already. I think I said this in my review. Nobody is shocked by the S Pen anymore. It's not a standout, amazing thing that makes you want to buy the Note. I think it's much lower in the hierarchy of what's made the Note popular than I think people want to admit. Of course, it's a differentiator and it works really well. If you're just walking into a store saying, I'm trying to decide between the Galaxy S8 Plus and the Note 8, you're not going to use the S Pen. You're only going to use it if you're that person that already is drawn to that thing. It's not going to just convert people over that they decide they're deciding between the S8 Plus and the Note 8. And they're like, okay, I'm going to spring for the Note 8 because I want all these things. Like that person is not that's like on the fence is not going to go to the S Pen. I think that, and it's because of that this is such a weird, it puts people in such a weird position to say that, you know, hey, you should probably just consider the Galaxy S8 Plus for, you know, a number of reasons.
Sure.
Part of which being the fact that it's just not all that different.
And my question is, cast your mind back a year. Is the idea that we have the S8 Plus now, how much of the fact the S8 Plus exists is tied to the fact that the Note 7 crashed and burned? If the Note 7 had just continued to go on as this, you know, relatively successful phone, would we have had a secondary, very big S8 Plus? Or would it have been, you know, maybe one phone or two phones, but at a smaller size? Because you then have the knock-on effect of, okay, you have GS8 Plus potentially eating into more lucrative Note 8 sales for Samsung. Whereas had the Note 7 thing not happened, maybe you have two phones at smaller sizes this year, and a Note 8 at that bigger 6.3-inch size is a much easier sell then for people who just want that bigger phone.
I think it's very interesting because they did a couple different strategies doing the Galaxy S8 Edge Plus with the Note 5 and then doing the Galaxy S7 Edge with the S7.
So we kind of been here before, right, with that situation.
Yeah, and I think that the only thing that would have changed is the S8 Plus wouldn't have been as big, and so there would have been a more of a clear, you know, step up between the S8 Plus and the Note 8. But as is, the S8 Plus got so big, and when you're talking about these tall, skinny phones, the Note 8, you know, it can only get so much taller. I remember that I had the phone for a few days. Daniel received the phone and he was just like, my God, it's so tall.
It's stupid and is what it is. It's
you can't go too much taller. I appreciate the fact that it's not that wide and you can actually put your hand around it in the same way that I loved the Note 7's, you know, compactness. But the problem is that it just gets so damn tall.
Okay, I think that, Russell, you use the Note 7, I think, more than anybody here.
That's probably true.
For some reason.
He might even have that thing still knocking around somewhere.
I do. It's right here.
Oh, damn it. You admitted it. I think we have this podcast is now illegal.
Great. They're going to come kicking my door in.
So that phone felt like the right shape, the right build, the right everything for the time. And it's funny that time seems so long ago, even though it's just over a year. But with the S8 and the G6 and the 2:1 plus aspect ratios, it doesn't seem like we're ever going to move back. It's not like they're going to release the Note 9 in a 16:9 aspect ratio. So we're basically stuck with this idea that we now have Samsung flagships that are going to be extremely tall. And
so I hit this in my review where I said, you know, and I don't think I was alone in this, that the Note 7 was the first Note that just kind of felt more like a slightly larger regular phone rather than this gigantic thing, because it was insanely compact. And a lot of the design elements we saw in the GS8 came from the Note 7 originally. We just all kind of forgot for, various reasons. But they just went in the exact opposite direction and were like, well, we already have the GS8 Plus. We can't make a phone that's the exact same size. So we're just going to make it slightly larger than that, which the thing is a centimeter taller than the Note 7 and 15% heavier than the Note 7.
And it's like you know, 8 inches taller than the Note 5. So if you're coming from a Note 5, it's basically like you're going from a phone to a
tablet. It's like
a
lightsaber.
But and there are a lot of people in Europe upgrading from an S6 Edge Plus, in the US upgrading from a Note 5, and they're going to be going from a size that they've gotten very accustomed to from the Note 3 or the Note 4 or, you know, the Note 5 that they already have, and this is going to be something that is like a tangible expansion in terms of size, in the way that the Note line hasn't really done since we went from Note 2 at 5.5 to Note 3 at 5.7.
And I totally get the complaint. Like, some people have said, you know, stop complaining about the size. The people that want the Note phones want a big screen. Totally understand that. What I'm trying to express to people is that this isn't just a normal big screen. The phone is huge in terms of being really tall and really heavy. And when you add together tall and heavy, it makes it top heavy. And it makes it a little bit tougher to kind of shift your hand around and use that top part of the screen or reach across the phone, because we're talking about a phone that almost weighs 200 grams and is, you know, like Daniel said, it's like 8.5 feet tall. So when you put those things together, it just feels a little unwieldy, more so than you would expect it to be considering how close it is to the GS8 Plus. I think the GS8 Plus feels much more manageable, even though the dimensions aren't that different. It's just a little bit more rounded, a little bit smaller, and a notable amount lighter. And that's kind of where this whole argument is. You know, you get basically the same amount of usable display, but it's more, general capabilities are all there, except for not having the S Pen and not having the secondary camera. And I'm sure we want to talk about the cameras.
And just briefly, you talk about size and weight there. Those are the two of the biggest things that I appreciate about the LG V30. The V30, if anything, feels a little bit too light. It's like 50 grams lighter than the Note. And also in terms of reachability and size, far easier to reach the top of the screen on this thing that I'm holding my hand right now than on the Note that I briefly played with in Berlin. Again, it goes back to the argument for the LG V30 as being, you know, this high-end big screen phone. Okay, you like a lot of the things about the Samsung phones, but here is a phone that is pretty much as good, doesn't have all these annoyances.
I don't have a single pair of pants that the Note 8 doesn't stick out of. That's basically, I'm just going to leave it there. Like,
yeah, I've been using it with this glorious Alcantara case on it, and it's too when you put a case on it, it goes to next level. Like, it just does not comfortably fit in your pants pockets for me, it'll fit in my pocket, but if I try to sit down with the phone in my pocket with a case on it, it's just not happening. That's like, people could talk about wanting that extra display, but that's just a usability hindrance. Is that worth 0.1 inch more display to push it over that edge? I don't think that is.
Anyway, cameras. So, pretty good?
Very good.
Very good. The live focus is a gimmick, and it's not mature, period. It doesn't work nearly as well as the iPhone 7 Plus. And
it works as well as the iPhone 7 Plus when it first launched the feature in beta, I would say.
Maybe. I just did a bunch of tests this afternoon, and the photos that I took with the iPhone 7 Plus are way nicer. The background is blurred. In a much more pleasing way. Even at full blur, the Note 8 is not quite as satisfying, I guess, if you're going for that effect. If you're not going for that effect, it's fine. But I also just think that the edge detection on the Note 8 isn't quite as good. That said, it's only been out for, it's not out yet. It's 8 days away from being launched publicly. Samsung could and probably will update this. So maybe not a fair comparison, since the iPhone's, you know, portrait mode has been out for in beta for over a year.
Yeah, that's kind of my point there.
This is firmware that Samsung is shipping for review now, that will be shipping in retail very shortly. I think, you know, Samsung isn't early to the party with this kind of feature. They've had plenty of time to get it ready. So I would hesitate to give them you know, too much leeway here.
I'm not giving them much leeway, to be honest. And I just don't think that it's not baked in a way that feels satisfying to me. Part of the portrait mode on the iPhone, the only reason that you want to use it is because it's simple. It's very simple. You touch, you know, you press it once. You don't mess around with the blur after the fact. It's a satisfying, simple feature, in my opinion. It's not always good, but it's good most of the time. I've not found that with the Note 8. I've had to mess with the blur levels after the fact a bunch of times. Some of the photos I've taken just aren't usable because the edge detection is so bad. I agree with you, Alex. It shouldn't be shipping like this. It doesn't feel like the feature is finished.
I mean, I think you've seen the couple of photos that I took with Live Focus that were just amazing, and you couldn't tell that there was, you know, necessarily a software effect applied to it. But those are few and far between. And I think the biggest issue that you hit on there is it's the edge detection. It's not necessarily the level of blur or that kind of thing. If you don't get the edge detection right, nothing else matters, because that's the thing that your eyes can instantly tell looks wrong.
Right.
The level of the blur in the background, like you could, you know, there are lots of variables in photos that can change that. The edge detection is like, yes, that was done artificially, and you can instantly tell that. It seems to mostly have an issue with, like, if you're taking a picture of a stop sign or, you know, the edge of a wall or something where there's just a perfectly sharp edge, it just can't do it. And that's not great when this is the one defining feature of the dual cameras. And the problem is that that's the one thing that makes it greater than the Galaxy S8 Plus. I really like taking the 2X photos. I think that the 2X camera is very capable, and there's very little difference in quality between that and the main one. But that in itself is not worth it. In the same way that like the V30 or G6, that wide angle camera is so much different from the main camera that just taking a photo with that lens on its own is worth it. That's not the same when you're talking about a 2X camera. So you have to do something like Live Focus or whatever. And when that doesn't work, it's kind of like, well, it's one of those features you're just going to forget about. And that's a problem. They don't want people to forget that this is a thing that they do, because we could be looking at a Galaxy S9 that has the exact same capabilities.
So it's interesting to me to look at all these first-gen dual camera phones that try to do this feature, and inevitably in the first sort of round of software isn't quite there. You know, this happened with Apple, it's happened with Huawei, it's happened this year with OnePlus. And it seems like, you know, everyone needs to maybe ship something that is just okay to begin with. Maybe through the course of like 6 months of software updates, they'll be able to get it right eventually. And actually something we didn't really touch on in the EVA podcast, because it hadn't been announced yet, is the chip that will eventually be in the Huawei Mate 10 and Mate 10 Pro, Kirin 970. And a big part of that is their own custom ISP, which is a dual ISP. It's designed around improving, you know, not only capture of moving subjects, but also improving the quality of this artificial bokeh effect as well.
Right.
And obviously this isn't new to Huawei. They've been doing this for like two generations now. Their effect is pretty good, but they're obviously still working on it, and part of that is hardware, part of that is software.
What I find really interesting, going back to the, you know, the idea of the combination of these two sensors and lenses, the iPhone 7 Plus has its main camera has an aperture, I think, of 1.8, maybe 1.7. But the secondary camera is f2.8, which is, there's a huge disparity there.
Yeah.
With the Note 8, it's less. It's f1.7 on the main sensor and f2.4 on the secondary sensor. So theoretically, there shouldn't be as much of a difference in terms of light capture and things like that. But what I'm
plus Plus, the Note has OIS, which is a huge thing.
It is. But what I found, because I like to take photos of my dog all day, every day, what I found is that even outside in great lighting, the secondary camera at 2x will not go above 1/30 shutter speed, like 1/30th of a second. And I can't get it to go higher unless I switch it to manual mode, which leads to blur almost every time because it's not my it's not my hand that's shaking. It's the subject that's moving. And that kind of leads me to believe that this wasn't really intended for action shots or anything other than just stationary portraiture or, you know, telephoto-like subjects, like taking a photo of a building. It wasn't tuned to be something that you could, you know, if I'm a parent standing on at the sideline of a soccer game and I want to take a photo of my kid running and trying to get the ball, I'm not going to do it with that 2X camera because it's just going to be a blurry mess. And I think that's a missed opportunity here.
And at night, it likes to do the iPhone thing, not as much, but it likes to fall back to that main sensor and just do a digital crop, which to Samsung's credit actually still looks really, really good, which is very surprising to me. But it doesn't do it as often. But even in those situations, the software says, yeah, even though things aren't, you know, your subject's not moving and your hands aren't moving that much, we can't get the shutter speed and the ISO where we want with this aperture. We have to go to the main sensor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is something Huawei was talking about in their Kirin 970 announcement last week as well. Talking about the fact that, okay, you can take great pictures of a stationary subject, but in order to actually get a great picture of a moving subject, you need to first identify that. The way you do that is using AI that's built into the chip that you can use to say, okay, what is in the center of the frame, what the user has tapped on is actually moving, so you use a faster shutter speed, and the result, hopefully, that they demonstrated, was that you use a faster shutter speed, you get your subject is in focus, there's less motion blur, and that's, you know, that's a whole different technical side to, it seems, what Samsung's doing in the Note 8 camera.
You know, it could improve, but I'm actually really excited for the Mate 10, largely because of the promise of the Mate 9, of the P10. I think Huawei is further ahead than Samsung is on this, you know, differential computation stuff with the secondary camera. And, you know, even though the Mate 9 didn't have an amazing camera, and the varied aperture was often over-exaggerated to the point of, you know, being comical, I think that there's a lot of good stuff in there. So
I mean, I think my closing thing about the Note 8's camera, though, is that it feels like we're nitpicking because we are. It's because the Galaxy S8 Plus gives you the core same camera experience as the Note 8. So you're only getting this little bit of difference. And again, it's, you know, bigger and more expensive.
This little bit of difference that only applies in bright to middling light anyway. We were talking about the fact before that you actually get a digital crop in low light. So it's maybe two-thirds of the time that you'll...
Light, but I mean, I would say that two-thirds of low light shots. But
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's not that bad. It will use that second lens, and it took some really good photos with that second lens at night. But again, it is a small thing that, you know, if the live focus, if you're not willing to try to get in there and take a bunch of live focus shots till you get one that works and you don't really care about that 2X, well, you're left with what is still a really, really good camera. And I took hundreds of fantastic photos with the Note 8, but I've also taken hundreds of the exact same quality of photo with the Galaxy S8, not even the S8 Plus.
Okay, so I before we move on, I have one question, and let's go to all three of you for this one. Why did Samsung choose to go with this format of secondary camera? Why not go the Huawei route with the monochrome sensor? Why not go the LG route with a wide-angle sensor or wide-angle lens? Why mimic, for all intents and purposes, Apple with its double zoom telephoto-like slash portrait mode second sensor? We'll start with, I don't know, whoever wants to go. Russell, what do you think?
I think Samsung is doing, you know, I think it feels like a mimic of Apple because it's the same kind of impetus is behind it. When you see people take pictures with a normal camera phone and they pinch to zoom all the way in until it's, you know, completely zoomed in, it's painful because you know that picture is going to suck and they're taking pictures of like their family and stuff. Anytime I go to like a, you know, a tourist spot, you see that from so many people where they pinch to zoom in and as far as they can go. And those photos look like crap when you get back and you go to look at them. So yeah, I can see, you know, obviously it looks like a copy of what Apple did at this point, but Apple had the same argument. Was it, you know, it was really ridiculous for people to zoom in on photos and have them suck. And this fixes that a little bit.
Yeah, you're right. It kind of does. That's a really good point. Andrew, what were you saying?
Well, I was saying that Apple is Samsung's competition. Samsung, when it's selling the Note 8, doesn't give a damn about the Huawei Mate 10 or the LG V30 for that matter. They don't have to play that exact game. They just say, you know, we might as well go with a very familiar formula because it, for as much as Huawei has been doing this for multiple generations, when people think about a dual camera smartphone and what it enables, they think about an iPhone 7 Plus because that's been, for better or worse, the standard of what a dual camera smartphone is and what it does, even with LG also doing something entirely different, which is something that I prefer. People are used to seeing lots of these portrait mode photos and being able to zoom in on their iPhone 7 Plus. And like Russell was saying, that's just a thing that every average person does on their phone because they don't know any better. And on the iPhone 7 Plus, they go to their friends and, you know, they were both taking, you know, photos of the same thing. And they're like, wow, mine turned out a lot better than yours. And that's because I have an iPhone 7 Plus. And Samsung can just basically play into that exact playbook.
Yeah, I think a large part of it is just because there is that direct competition between Samsung and Apple there, whereas there, you know, Samsung maybe doesn't care too much about what LG is doing, even though it's very compelling in its own right. My question is how things are going to progress next year. Obviously, this year, basically everyone that's doing a dual camera setup has two, maybe three choices to go to. Do you do wide angle? Do you do zoom? Or do you do try and do the black and white thing? The black and white thing kind of hasn't worked too well. It's worked okay on the Huawei side because they've had a couple of generations to refine it. I think next year probably is the year that we start seeing, you know, three cameras in a phone. You look at Samsung next year. Okay, maybe the dual camera comes to the GS9. How do you then differentiate the Note, which presumably is going to have even fewer things to differentiate it next year
if everything is
dual camera? Well, this is the thing. You maybe go to three. You know, maybe Samsung decides, okay, the LG thing is worth emulating. You know, we get rid of our competition on the Android side as well as the Apple side. And, you know, you've got enough room back there with the giant bar that you already have with all this crap sitting on the back of the phone that maybe it makes sense to have, you know, regular actual wide angle, not fake wide angle like they're calling it now.
And they removed the fingerprint sensor to put a third camera in, print it.
Exactly, yeah. Hopefully, that was the rumor, right? With the Note 9, they're going to have fingerprint sensor below the glass finally now. So maybe that frees up room to have three cameras around the back. And a lot of the reason for not doing that is technical limitations of the chips we have right now. Maybe next year you have a Snapdragon 845 or whatever that actually lets you have three cameras active at the same time.
I don't mean to interrupt. BGR just said that the 845 does not exist. So it's not a thing. Let's not talk about it. It's not a real chip. Okay?
Okay. Fake chip.
No, I completely agree. What's really interesting, actually, Alex, going along with your point, was that Samsung is calling its main camera a wide-angle camera this year.
Yeah.
Why?
Partly because that's what Apple calls it, I guess. Apple calls its regular camera wide angle, so of course Samsung's going to do the same. They're direct competitors. It makes sense to use the same nomenclature. But, it also makes sense in terms of the competition with LG and the fact that some other manufacturers are doing actual wide angle. You, if you're buying a Samsung phone, you look at it, you say, oh, it has wide angle as well. Why do I care about LG's wide angle when actually, you know, LG's doing real wide angle, not just regular angle?
Right.
It's confusing, man. Unless we get into focal lengths, but then numbers become involved. So,
well, I do think that LG's decision to stick with a wide angle, true wide angle lens for its V30 and presumably the next phone in the G series is shrewd, because there are increasing number of people who find this cinematic, you know, secondary camera to be very compelling. And I love it. I think that I far prefer using a wide angle, true wide angle camera over the 2X zoom. So, you know, go LG.
Yep. Agree.
All right. Let's, do you want to talk a little bit about this GS8 Active, Andrew, before we move on to other things?
I will give you 2 minutes of thoughts, as I work on a review for it. People are excited about it because it has a 4,000 milliamp hour battery, and this is exactly what people ask for. When they're making the Homer Simpson car of phones, they think, oh, if I had the Galaxy S8, but it had a 1,000 milliamp hour larger battery, it would be fantastic. Except for it weighs more than the Note 8, and it's pushing, it lands between the Galaxy S8 and S8 Plus in terms of size. That's just not worth it to get a 1,000 milliamp hour improvement in battery. It's just not.
And it looks like the bottom of a shoe as well.
Looks like the bottom of a shoe. I think it looks better than the last one. The back is kind of this soft textured pattern rather than that kind of like hard nylon-y pattern. And it's not camo, which is awesome. But it still has, these big bumper corners. And it has screws on the outside that I'm sure do absolutely nothing to protect it. It has a big protection around the camera and, you know, things like that. The fingerprint sensor is a little easier to touch, actually, because of the raised nature of it. The thing is just huge. It feels like you could hammer in a tent spike with it, which you may want to do. And if you're somebody legitimately that, you know, if you're on AT&T and you're looking at a Galaxy S8 that you're just going to put in an OtterBox Defender or something, sure, give this thing a look, because you're that person and you're gonna pick up a 1,000 extra milliamp hour, and it's less likely to crack in the front because it has a flat display rather than a curved one. But everyone else who's going to do anything less than that should just, you know, grab the GS8. You can put a case on it, sure. It's okay to, you know, like, the battery life on the GS8 is fine. You don't need to go all the way to the nuclear option of getting an S8 Active for the extra 1,000 milliamp hour. I just don't think the whole package is worth it in that way.
I'm looking at cases now, and there are already rugged cases for the Galaxy S8 Active, which is
just
amazing.
Oh, my God, really?
I mean, let's do it.
Don't do
like,
that, people.
Yo, dog, I heard you like cases, so I got a case for your case.
I hope OtterBox makes
a defender for case. The Active.
Well, but I think that's kind of a valid point there, is that, you know, this is a phone that you shouldn't have to put a case on, kind of like the Force editions from Motorola. And, you know, this phone has a Samsung brand on it, and it's considered an NS8, so we compare it to the other kind of flagship class phones that are out there. But this really ends up being like the best of the ruggedized phones that you can buy, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's why I say, like, if you're going into AT&T looking at an S8, don't think that like there's the S8 Active right there and you're choosing between those two. Think about if you're going into an AT&T store looking for a rough, rugged phone, this is like, you're going to buy a rough and tumble phone by default if that's your situation. This is definitely the best one in terms of you still get a great screen and the performance and the camera and everything, but you don't have to spend an extra $50 on an OtterBox to put around it.
And you get an extra 1,000 milliamp hours of battery. So you make
and
up
you
the
can
extra
drive a tent stake. Stake
yeah. Yeah, so you get the, you know, it's the same physical size that maybe your regular S8 would be with that massive case on, except you get the addition of, you know, the really great battery life as well.
I know if Jerry were here, he'd be hooting and hollering about how that makes this the perfect Galaxy S8. But
as a flat screen.
Yeah, I mean, there is something to be said about people who want the phone that isn't curved and has the bigger battery and are willing to, you know, trade up to this larger, thicker size to get it.
Yeah, I just think that, yes, it has the flat screen, which is a little bit easier to use. And yes, it has a larger battery. If you're not someone that needs the rugged nature of it, it's not worth it for those things. You get the big trade-off of just, like, the flat screen is a positive. but it's so much wider, thicker, and heavier that you lose all the ergonomic advantage of having the flat screen. So now you're back to something that's clunkier and harder to use. So it's kind of like a false economy of you thinking of all the good things and ignoring the downsides from a regular user perspective. But again, drive a tent stake. If that's your thing, go buy it. Although $850 at AT&T.
Yeah.
Which is the new normal for flagships today, by the way.
This is your new normal.
Oh. Question though, it has a plastic covering over the screen, right? Like the Moto Z2 Force. It's not just Gorilla Glass 5.
I cannot confirm or deny that. I know it is Gorilla Glass 5. I would not be surprised if there's an extra coating of something on it, but I cannot tell yet.
Okay. When I was using it last week, it didn't appear to have anything on it. It could be there's a factory fitted screen protector or something, but
because there is still a lip around the edge, it's you can put this thing face down on a perfectly flat table and it wouldn't touch the glass. So they have built up a lip around it, but you can tell, I'm sure, by me tapping on the phone next to the microphone. It feels like glass to me.
Interesting. Because I have heard that it was the same type of plastic covering as the Moto Z2 Force that would make it...
It does not feel like garbage like the Moto Z2 Force, if that's what you mean.
Drink.
Drink. And then just fall
be
asleep.
Sad.
Yeah. Okay, so... I don't know. Z2 the active line is interesting. It's less interesting these days than it used to be, I think. But yep. it's still interesting. What is interesting? Let's move this on. Let's pick up the energy, guys. Okay, let's move on. Google may buy Motorola. This is an amazing
again.
They did that once.
What year is it?
hey everybody, it's September 7th, 2012. My name is Dorniel Border. we're on Earth 2. Hillary Clinton is president of Canada.
We got to warn some people about some stuff. It's 2012.
Oh, yeah, you're right, actually. Let's go back in time and fix some major, major problems. And then win the lottery or something. And anyway, I don't know.
So, Daniel, what is Google buying?
Google is maybe buying HTC? Question mark.
Or HTC's... smartphone business, supposedly.
Correct.
So I'll just lead off. So this is a report today which comes from the Taiwanese press, from originally from Commercial Times, was reported as well by DigiTimes. Again, large pinch of salt required with anything from single source in those two publications. But obviously HTC is not in great shape right now. There's a report from Bloomberg a couple of weeks back suggesting there would be strategic changes, possibly business unit spin-offs that were being considered as a result of the fact that, the U11 has kind of peaked early. Big sharp decline supposedly this past month in August on that phone. And just the fact that if you're HTC, you've got a single Pixel phone to prop you up for the rest of the year, you're not probably in a great financial position there. So the solution to that, according to today's report, is going to be either an increased strategic partnership between HTC and Google, maybe an investment there of, injection of cash into HTC smartphone business, or potentially, and this is the more interesting, exciting, newsworthy thing, potentially Google just straight up buying HTC's smartphone business. Obviously, a ton of potential there in terms of what they could do by refocusing that to go into their own hardware division, making Google phones, Google tablets, maybe even watches or other devices as well. We have a no comment from HTC. No one I've spoken to, off the record really knows anything. So may happen, may not. The report suggests that things will be wrapped up at the latest by the end of the year. No one's really saying anything. But, of course, this would make sense. There's a long-running partnership between these two companies. HTC isn't doing very well. Google has money to spend. Google wants to build out this hardware business. It would not surprise me if this was true. But, of course, we just don't know yet.
So I don't understand this situation of why Google would try to outright just buy HTC's smartphone business away from them versus making an investment in the company.
Because if you just buy it straight up, then I suppose there's less ambiguity there in terms of the leadership of the company, that Google can just come in and effectively take over the manufacturing base and the infrastructure that HTC has, like wholesale. They're in charge now. They can decide what happens. They can, okay, play through the next round of HTC phones that might come out next year and then say, okay, we're taking this this company, which was producing good stuff, but frankly didn't have the money to, it didn't have the money to meet the table stakes of this industry. And they can say, okay, we're going to, as Google, we're going to have financial control. We're going to put money into this. And also we're going to have total control over it. Maybe you do that to a certain extent with an investment, but you could do it with much more control and much less ambiguity if you just straight up buy them.
So this is going to end with Lenovo owning HTC.
No, it isn't.
Right?
It isn't. I mean, this,
I mean,
no,
you're,
come
you're
on, come
describing
on.
2013.
I'm not. Like, you don't have Sanjay Jha threatening to sell them to Microsoft or whatever the hell he was doing. This is a completely different situation. Obviously, HTC is in a great financial position. You know, Motorola was kind of on the rocks, but not so much back in 2012. But I think the situation here is very, very different. You have two companies with a long history of partnership. There's an ongoing, you know, we've heard from multiple people, 3-year Pixel agreement, of which we're now like halfway through. So regardless of what happens, there is that contract there. I don't, you know, when HTC purchased Motorola, it was largely for the patents. It was largely so they wouldn't go to someone else, as was being threatened at the time. HTC.
That's why I don't understand that they have to purchase them. There's no, like, they don't need all, Google doesn't need all that IP. They, you know, HTC is already happy to take a Pixel contract off of Google. Google doesn't need the overhead of trying to run another smartphone business. They completely failed to integrate or take care of Motorola. Why would they do that unless they really think that HTC is so horribly mismanaging things that would make more sense to take on the massive amount of overhead of buying the business off of them?
Frankly, maybe they do think that. I mean, the difference in my mind between the two situations, the Motorola acquisition all those years ago and the potential HTC acquisition now, Google basically bought Motorola for the patents. And then they had this awkward situation of, oh, we now own a smartphone manufacturer. If they were to buy HTC, they would be buying a smartphone manufacturer to have the nuts and bolts of a smartphone manufacturer. They would no longer have to negotiate contracts with this separate company. That would be part of Google. And they would be able to, from start to finish, design, manufacture all their own phones, potentially all their own tablets, all their own watches, maybe even all their own laptops eventually. There is immense value in that kind of manufacturing base and infrastructure to Google right now. Especially with the state of HTC right now, where you have a devalued brand, but all this design talent and manufacturing talent behind it.
So I also think it's worth pointing out that Google hardware is still run by the head of Motorola at the time. Rick Osterloh has returned to Google as the company's head of hardware. And there is a renewed push within Google to be a hardware manufacturer a la Microsoft or Apple, more Microsoft than Apple, because Google is still primarily an ad seller. It makes the vast majority, 89, 90% of its revenue and profit from ads, but it's now making money from Chromecasts, from Pixels, from Google Wi-Fi, a whole lot of devices that it needs manufacturing capabilities to scale up. And I'm sure it wants to scale up.
But if you look at HTC historically, the one thing they've lacked that Samsung or even LG or even Sony hasn't is money from other business units to meet the table stakes to pour into the smartphone business. They've always, first and foremost, been a phone business. That's been their biggest business area. They haven't had money from other lucrative areas to pour into that. And that's what you need to do if you want to be successful in smartphone hardware. And that's what Google could bring to that infrastructure of HTC that exists right now.
Russell, how much money is HTC making from Vive, if any?
Well, a lot of, you know, they definitely were making money from the hardware initially, but they just gave it a $200 price cut. So the, you know, the margin that was there is not there anymore. But in turn, they flipped it over to services with Viveport as a subscription model, both for consumers and businesses. And that gives them, you know, kind of a dedicated retail, you know, revenue stream from VR. And it's also important to keep in mind that, like, we heard these exact same stories about HTC 2 weeks ago for their VR business, that you know, the VR stuff was going to be, you know, shucked off from HTC and sold, you know, Vive as a separate company somewhere. And what I thought was funny about that was that Google has a vested interest in both HTC Mobile and HTC VR, because the HTC VR platform, they're the hardware partners for the standalone Daydream headset.
Mm-hmm. Which is coming, you know, when? Later this year, right?
It's coming later this year. Yeah, it's you know, something that we'll see probably in October, along with the announcement of the Pixel too. You know, so this is not a separate, you know, set of organizations for HTC. These are you know, different channels within the same company that they're working with for a lot of different things. You know, Google has several very popular VR apps that are on the Vive first and didn't come to other platforms until much later, with Tilt Brush and several others. So, you know, For Google to only be interested in the mobile side of the company seems, you know, unusual given the other aspects of the business that they do with this company.
Essentially. But then, I mean, obviously HTC is probably going to be more willing to offload, you know, its perennially struggling mobile business than it is potentially its more promising VR business.
Sure, yeah.
And I think we have to talk about scale a little bit here. Google bought Motorola for over $12 billion. HTC as a whole is not even worth $2 billion currently in the open market. So the smartphone business is surely a small portion of that. It wouldn't be a massive outlay for Google to do this. But my whole thing is, it still comes back to, HTC is not in a power position when they're talking about making these deals with Google as just a manufacturing partner. Why would, you know, Google can surely dictate all of those terms anyway. I'm just not sure what they benefit in the, especially in the short term, of taking on this basically a retread job on a business that's not doing very well, when they could have access to all of HTC's manufacturing just through a partnership and not have to take on all of the crappy parts of, you know, spinning down and finishing out whatever product cycles they have and slowly backing away from customer service and all that kind of stuff. That's like a 5-year deal of breaking down and shutting down all of HTC's current operations, because surely they know that if Google were to buy HTC's smartphone business, they're not going to keep making Desire phones and selling them at low margins and not making any money. You know, they would stop doing that and just use HTC for what, just taking it back to its core business from years and years ago of just being an ODM for other companies. You know, why would they go through all that process then on their own?
Well, maybe they really Google's love that squeezing feature.
Oh, yeah.
They're just all about it.
So my thing there is, Google maybe sees an advantage in being able to easily buy all the stuff that HTC has, all the value they have in terms of being able to make phones now. Whereas if they leave it any later, maybe the company, maybe that side of the company get, you know, collapses, gets sold off to someone else. Maybe they view this as their time to get in there, so that they can use the infrastructure that is there to effectively incorporate into their own smartphone business or hardware business more broadly. I mean, yeah, you're right. Does Google want to continue making Desire phones? No. Are we going to, you know, if this happens, are we going to see, we'll probably see a U12? Will we see a U13? Probably not. But yeah, I mean, Google obviously doesn't see value in the brand. You know, it's been a while since HTC, you know, there's literally been any market value in the HTC brand. So that's probably, you know, if this purchase was to happen, that would go away. Like I said, it comes down to the money that Google could provide and the infrastructure that HTC has there in terms of being able to build the products that Google wants to build. And if this is all part of Google, then you don't have to deal with contracts. You don't have to deal with anything else. You own the stuff. You just go out there, put the money in and make it, and there are no contracts involved. You're not worrying about, is HTC going to go belly up? Do you have to deal with management at the HTC level that you're signing contracts with if you're Google? If you just buy it for, say, you know, $2, $3 billion, you just have all this at your disposal. And that's a really, potentially, a really useful way to actually get into hardware in a serious way.
So you think that this would be a good deal for them?
I think it would be a good deal for Google in that it would slot quite nicely into the hardware thing they're trying to build. I think it would be a good deal for HTC in that it would let them kind of bow out in a way that doesn't just, you know, before the, vultures start circling any more than they currently are. Yeah, I think it would basically be a good thing if HTC can't turn its business around, which this year basically seems that they can't, unfortunately.
And which other companies could potentially buy HTC? It's an interesting thought exercise, because we've been saying for years that HTC isn't long for this world, but this was the lowest monthly revenue they've ever had since smartphones, and market share is pretty much non-existent.
So, for example, about 3 or 4 years ago, HTC as a whole was worth about $6.5 billion, and now, like I said, they're under two. So they're definitely reaching the point where, if you're talking about just spinning off selling the smartphone business, it's not going to be. I would be surprised if it was worth half of that total valuation, considering the trajectory of smartphones versus everything else for them. Any of the big technology companies could make a $1 billion purchase, no problem.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't get anyone who's already in the smartphone market to do that. I mean, even you know, there was talk at some point of a merger between HTC's phone business and Asus's. I don't think that's happening anytime soon. The interest just isn't there. And of course, Asus has its own stuff that it's doing. It's also not a big presence in the West. So what would really be achieved by that? Probably not a lot. Microsoft has dabbled in the phone business in the past unsuccessfully. Is Apple going to want to get in there? You know, they probably hire a bunch of ex-HTC people, as they have done in the past. They probably don't see much value in the rest of the company. The only, the most likely party there is Google, unless we're talking about maybe an Amazon. That's possibly an outside candidate there. Those are the only two. Of people who would potentially have an interest in getting into the smartphone industry or getting into it once again, and also people who have a ton of money to spend.
So Andy Rubin.
Well, do we want to touch on Essential Phone like 3 weeks in?
No. I'm just saying, like, it's interesting to me that Essential, the company, and HTC are sort of merging in their desires. They are focusing on just the high end with extremely simple software. High-end hardware.
The difference is Essential is doing that out of design. HTC is doing that because they don't really have anywhere else left to go.
Well, they tell you that it's by design now too.
They'd be wrong
by necessity.
Yeah.
Good news. My Essential phone got an 888 megabyte update. So it should be 888 megabytes better.
Oh, good. Is the camera? Can it take photos now?
It's still really laggy to switch between HDR and not HDR. And when you turn on HDR, it turns on the flash still. So there's that.
Oh, good. Okay. I'm glad that's been taken care of.
So nothing has changed probably, but it's up to the September 5th security patch. And phone is still beautiful.
Well, we do know that we know from a couple more leaks that the Pixel 2 is going to look a lot like the Pixel. It's going to be waterproof, which is unlike the Pixel, and it's going to have dual cameras, dual front-facing speakers in lieu of a 3.5-millimeter headphone jack. Other than that, we have heard that the Snapdragon 836 is not a thing, and that it's going to ship with the 835, and that there's going to be a boost up to 64 gigs of base storage, and that it's probably going to ship with Android 8.1, which, Alex, as you pointed out months ago, is Google's strategy now. It releases the latest version of Android, in this case Oreo, for its older devices, and then bumps gives the new phone a nice bump with a .1 update. What are we expecting this year from 8.1, if anything, in terms of new features?
I'm not entirely sure it will be an 8.1 with the way Android versions have worked in the past. Generally, you get a 0.1 or a 0.1 update when you have a new platform version. It will depend if Google has enough to justify a new platform version. If they do, it'll be 8.1. If they don't, maybe it'll be 8.0. It'll still be a maintenance release, but it'll be 8.0.1. Either way, I wouldn't necessarily freak out about the differences between 8.0 and 8.1. There's zero information out there right now about what will be new in it. And, you know, the differences between 7.0 and 7.1 were relatively trivial anyway. You were dealing with stuff like launcher shortcuts when you long press on an app icon, things of that nature. You know, the important platform level stuff is all in, you know, the 7.0 or the 8.0 update. Yeah, and it's to my mind, it's going to be more interesting to see what happens with the phones from other manufacturers that are shipping with either 8.0 or 8.1. So we have Sony obviously going really, really early with 8.0. Big deal for them because they're disappointing in other areas. You have Huawei very likely getting in early on 8.0 with the Mate 10 in mid-October, which is a little bit earlier than they went last year. We have rumors recently of OnePlus potentially pushing out public betas of 8.0 as early as late September. So all of this stuff potentially points to a little bit of an acceleration in pushing out new versions, not a whole lot compared to last year. I certainly wouldn't put too much emphasis on differences between 8.0 and 8.1, or if it exists, or 8.0.1. It's going to more be about, you know, what makes more sense for manufacturers in terms of where they are in their product cycles.
Okay, so from that perspective, then, if the Pixel doesn't have any, you know, whiz bang software differentiation, we're looking really at least for the smaller version, at a very iterative update. This is, you know, for people who may not have upgraded from a Nexus phone to the first Pixel. With the larger one, though, the Pixel XL 2017, that seems like it's going to be a much more significant bump.
Yeah, so the rumors around the smaller Pixel are that it's basically going to be a recreation of last year with some minor design tweaks, supposedly the glass bar being above the fingerprint scanner now, so it's a little bit slimmer along the top. Single camera once again, front-facing speakers, that'll be a new thing. No headphone jack, that's stupid, as we all know. And hopefully, along with that more, you know, derivative design will come, a more affordable price point. Hopefully, you know, Pixel isn't going to launch, with a £650 or whatever price tag for the base model, especially if you have the more expensive XL. It'll be interesting to see what LG can do with the XL. As far as we can tell, we're dealing potentially with slimmer bezels, with a larger screen, and maybe not a whole lot more than that. And again, we'll have to wait and see what happens, whether any of the rumored features like, an EdgeSense-like squeezable thing, whether that ends up materializing. Google may be playing it relatively safe this year. But then again, maybe we're following kind of like more of an Apple-style playbook with this thing, where, okay, you have 8.0, it launches with the Pixels. Most of the new software stuff is already, you know, goes to the new phones anyway, so when the new phone comes out, it's more about the hardware features and not stuff that is new in the software that's exclusive to it.
Squeeze away.
We'll see.
Okay, so let's finish up today and talk a little bit about AR Core, because this is something that launched in the last few weeks, Russell, and it's really interesting, and it's sort of confusing to me because Tango already exists. So tell me a little bit about AR Core and why Google announced this new initiative for augmented reality with what they say are 100 million Android phones by the end of the year.
Yeah, so I mean, AR Core is taking all of the computing stuff from Tango Core, which is the software that hides behind all of the extra sensors that go in a Tango phone, to do, you know, kind of lesser forms of augmented reality in any kind of phone. And, you know, Apple made their announcement about AR Kit and demonstrated that this was a deeply popular thing that people actually cared about. And so whether it was something they were already doing or had planned to do. You know, Google obviously accelerated their timetable, or just straight up copied Apple. I'm down with either, really, and are now releasing this this, you know, kind of simpler form of augmented reality that'll be available on a ton of different phones instead of just phones that have the special Tango hardware.
So why pick? Obviously, the Pixel and Pixel XL makes sense. Why pick the S8? And I know that is an obvious thing, but why not just roll it out to every phone that's running a Snapdragon 835? Why focus on just those two devices or those two series of devices?
That camera, though. And that's really what it comes down to, is the Galaxy S8 camera, when it comes to low light stuff, means surface detection is a lot easier. It's actually kind of sad. I have the developer preview on both my S8 and my Pixel, and there is a noticeable difference in performance between the Pixel and the S8 in low light, like as far as detecting a surface and being able to drop an augmented object on a surface. The S8 will routinely pick a surface faster, not always more accurately, but always faster than the Pixel will.
Interesting. Even though the Pixel's low light performance with photography is renowned.
Well, all of that is processing. It's post-processing, not necessarily the sensor, you know, whereas, you know, Samsung sensor is more, I don't know exactly what the difference is here, but, you know, we're not talking about the amazing effects of a picture taken with a Pixel XL with the HDR Plus on. This is just having the camera on and taking a normal photo. You can see that there are some pretty clear differences.
So how much of an impact is AR Core going to have on the way that we use our phones in the next year?
I really don't think it's going to have any substantial. I think my longest belief, and this goes for, I started saying this about ARKit a while ago, and I'm going to continue saying it about AR Core until I'm wrong, and then I will very vocally let everyone know that I'm wrong. But I think this is a very big but very simple flash in the pan. I think this is there are going to be a whole bunch of really cute things that you're going to be able to do with ARKit and AR Core that are going to lead to, you know, some pretty funny pictures and some clever videos, and there will be some fun stories told, you know, on your coffee table in front of you, where you can kind of move around this adventure and see it. But this isn't going to, you know, when it's all said and done, you're still going to go back and use the normal Facebook app. You're still going to go back and use your normal email client. You know, you're still going to go back and use a normal web browser. These are, you know, what's happening here is, I'm not going to go as far as to call them gimmicks, but they're, everything that I've seen so far for both ARKit and AR Core, they're simple distractions and not like long-term games or, you know, more in-depth stories or a way to convert things that are, you know, kind of practical day-to-day things that we do on our phones into augmented reality.
Okay. So, we're not going to see another Pokemon, essentially.
I mean, Pokemon Go will be improved to support ARKit and AR Core. We already know that that's coming, but I don't think we're going to see another, you know, massive surge where people go out and do stuff, you know, just because augmented reality. And that's been the argument for a long time now, was that augmented reality was never the thing that made Pokemon Go special. Pokemon was the thing that made Pokemon Go special, mm-hmm. because it's an IP that existed for 20 years and never went away. You know, so there were multiple generations of people who were interested in that experience. The augmented reality thing, I still play the game. I've never seen a single person with AR mode on when playing with other people. It is the first thing I think a lot
so
of people
bad.
Turn off.
But maybe it'll get so good when AR
yeah,
Core is activated. Who knows?
I mean, maybe. And you know, this is not to discount the things that I've seen, you know, developers do already with ARKit and AR Core. You know, there are some really clever things that are happening, but I don't see them as more than distractions for most people right now. You know, I don't think this is any different from... I think this is the software version of the Bixby button.
Oh, snap.
Hush.
Like, it's a thing that I was like, hey, this is cool, and now it's fun. And then, you know, a week later, I'm really tired of hearing about it.
Oh, come on. We never thought Bixby was cool.
Well, hey, now, the actual Bixby, you know, application control service, like the way that you can send it to manipulate other apps just by programming it into a voice, I was all over that for a week. And then, you know, it was faster for me to just go in and do it myself and sit there and watch my phone, navigate my phone for me. It was really bizarre. But the novelty was definitely there for me as far as several Bixby services.
Disagree. Bixby was never cool or fun.
I'll be honest. Even though it's now available in Canada, I have never used it to navigate my phone.
As far as Samsung's concerned, you use it 11 times a day because I'm sure that they keep a counter of every time somebody accidentally wakes up Bixby.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the same. Hey,
there are no accidents. You meant
you
that Bixby
definitely
press.
Did it on purpose. We're going to get some kind of like onstage announcement next year that like 150 bajillion people have activated Bixby 7 times an hour. And all of us know that none of them were on purpose.
How many of those were just trying to turn the volume down?
Yeah.
Well, it's sort of like Facebook when it games the you know, the daily active users metric with its myriad companies that it owns, Instagram, WhatsApp. If you even if it denies it, but it must be true that if you give any of its ads an impression anywhere on the internet, you count as a daily active user. So there are a lot of ways to manipulate data, and Samsung will certainly do that next year. I think the statistic, Andrew, if I'm not mistaken, during the briefing for the Note 8 was that 30% of people use Bixby every day right now, which is...
Yeah, I remember a 30% number, but man, that seems crazy, and I wouldn't be surprised if they said that that was true.
Yeah, that's what I wrote down in my notes, but maybe I was just hallucinating. Speaking of hallucinations, Russell, it is your birthday today. Happy birthday. You are 1 year older. I just want to say a very happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
How are you feeling?
Good. Good. It's been a good year. Next year is going to be good, too.
I hope so.
Lots of positive things everywhere.
Most places. So that was a downer. I'm sorry. Everything's good. Everything is fine. Everything's, you know, My Little Pony. All over. So I think we're going to end it there because it's already gone. What are we at?
Oh, you think?
An hour and 45 minutes. This is becoming a trend with us. So I think we're gonna leave it there for another week, unless anybody else has anything to say, or you guys are all talked out. You wanna touch on the Moto X 4 for another 45 minutes?
It's a phone.
Done. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see. No. Let's go around. Let's say a quick goodbye, Andrew. Where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at Andrew Martinick, and that's the way to go.
And Android Central Note 8 review, read it, watch it,
of course.
Love it.
Watch the video again.
Yeah, it's so good.
Great video review on YouTube.
And subscribe. Alex, where can people find you?
You can find me at Alex Dobie on the Twitters and the Instagrams. Yeah, look at my Instagram if you want to find some pretty pictures from more recently the LG V30 and before that, I guess phones I was using before that, so OnePlus 5, other stuff as well. Yeah, follow me on androidcentral.com. We will have a video of the LG V30, including a review video, which should be pretty good, hopefully, in the next week or so. So my stuff will be there.
Excellent. Can't wait for that. And Russell, thank you for being with us today. Where can people find you if they want to learn
more? Podcast. I am at Russell Holly pretty much everywhere. And if you take a look at any of my feeds, you will see me jump back and forth between all of the R things that I'm doing and all of the just Star Wars themed everything.
Yeah, we didn't get to that.
Dropped in our laps over the last week. I'll be doing lots of stuff with that.
Did you buy anything cool for Force Friday number 2?
I got the little bits engineering kit for my kids so that they could go and build their own droid.
And you got a Sphero droid.
Well, yeah, Sphero sent those to me. The Sphero units, and that's the BB-9E, which is the evil version of BB-8. We don't really know yet. And an R2-D2, and the R2-D2 made me so happy because it even gets mad and falls down. Like, it'll rock it, like, on purpose. There's a button you push where it'll rock back and forth and then just, like, topple over.
Yeah, check it out on Android Central. You got some great gifts in there. It's really worth checking out.
Yeah, it's good times.
All right. Well, everybody listening, if you're in Florida, if you're in Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, anywhere in the Caribbean, I hope you're safe or will be safe. Through Hurricane Irma, it's going to be a trying few days, and we wish you all the best.
Should reach out to us on Twitter and let us know that you're safe.
Yes, please do. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you next week.
See you.
Bye-bye.
See you later. Bye.